Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Jonathan Fettervorm. He's an artist and an author, and we're talking about his latest book, Moonbound, Apollo 11 and the Dream of Spaceflight. Jonathan, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks for having me.
Now, for the benefit of the audience, this book surprised me at how far-ranging it was. I mean, it tells the story of the Apollo 11 moon landing, which sadly needs to be retold because most people don't know about it. But through the different chapters of that, you really literally go back to ancient times and how people thought about the moon, through the whole discovery of how our solar system works, through the discovery of rocketry and that, and then the development of the space program. It's an incredible amount of material. Talk to me about organizing this. That's got to be one of the major efforts in this.
Oh, man, it sure was. I started out thinking, when I first started this project, I read some of the mission transcripts from Apollo 11, and that's what piqued my curiosity.
But well, you write in the book that NASA has kept incredible volumes of records.
Yeah. I mean, it's all publicly available. Most of it's digitized. It's a great place to start doing some research. But the more that I looked into it, I came at this pretty fresh, not knowing much about. I mean, I didn't even know Michael Collins' name, the name of the third astronaut orbiting the moon, and so I was starting fresh, and I think that sort of helped because I really just followed my curiosities throughout this story, and that's sort of how, you know, as I'm reading about the moon, I start thinking, well, how did the moon really start to exist? And suddenly we're 4.5 billion years in the past looking at, you know, planets colliding.
I guess what surprised me is that you managed to fit it in as compact a form. I mean, this is still a pretty substantial book. But this easily could have been several volumes of encyclopedic size. But you were able to really sort of swing this together so there's a flow, which is important, and it works. And I'm really impressed.
Oh, thank you. I think a lot of that has to do with the format of comics, too.
It does, and I'm a person who's a huge fan of the graphic treatment.
Oh, yeah, nice. Yeah, I think it allows you to get to make these leaps in a lot, you know, sharper, quicker succession than with prose. You can make some pretty big jumps, and I think people will stick along for the ride.
Now, you've done two other previous histories. You did one on the first atom bomb, Trinity, another one, Battle Lines, which was about the Civil War. Talk to me about why you're sort of going this route of treating big issues in history.
Well, my first historical comic was a translation of Beowulf, and that in college, and that sort of was the first time that I thought about the idea of using comics to tell historical stories. But the stuff that I was doing then was pretty esoteric, and I think I realized at some point that I wanted to try to do some bigger, more wide-ranging themes. Hence the atomic bomb.
Are there teachers now who use your books in their classrooms?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I hear from them every once in a while.
I have to believe this is a perfect way to introduce high school students, but actually college-level students, too.
Oh, yeah, totally.
To this material. Talk to me about storyboarding this. That's going to be another huge issue. You got the material. Now you have to storyboard it out, and you don't want to make it too ginormous so that it's unwieldy. But storyboarding must be a huge issue.
Yeah, and it's a big change of pace because it took a year or two to write the book, and then once you're done writing, you can't call it quits. You then have to figure out how to illustrate all the little things that you described in your script. That's when I start to hate my former self. Like, I set up these impossible panels to draw. But the storyboarding is really where you figure out what's possible, what I can do, and then what's the problem, what needs to be revisited. And the trick, like you say, is to do it. You want it to be a small little drawing that doesn't take too much time in case you need to throw it away, but it also has to be detailed enough so that when you come back to it, when you're doing the final drawings, there's enough information there to know what you were talking about.
You also use color, interestingly, in this book. Talk to me about it.
Oh, thanks. Color's always been a big insecurity of mine. I mean, Trinity, the first book I did about the atomic bomb, was black and white. I think it's sort of easier to avoid having to think about the color, but this was the first time I really embraced it, and I used it kind of as an organizational structure. The book is divided into sections that are I call it the present day, but it's 1969. It follows the action of the moon landing itself. And then in between those chapters, we jump, you know, like you said, back in time through vast distances. I wanted to use color to try to break that up so it was obvious wherever you were in the book, it was obvious what was going on.
Were you surprised when you talked to people about how little people now today know about the moon landing?
Yes and no. I was increasingly surprised the more I knew about it. But like I said, I started as one of those people who I grew up hearing about it, but always it was just sort of a foregone conclusion, and so it didn't warrant much investigation. I was like, oh yeah, the moon landing, I know about that. So I had some sympathy with people who didn't know a lot of this stuff, because you just sort of take it for granted as American.
It's amazing, because having lived through the moon landing, it was appointment TV. Like every single television on the face of the planet probably was tuned to that. I mean, we don't have that kind of event anymore that had that kind of attention and amazement. And the amazing thing is that when they actually stepped off, that it was broadcast live. Yeah. I mean, that was just an amazing moment and it was almost a unifying feeling for the planet too.
Imagine.
But yeah, what was it? Now, there's so much information in your book, we can't possibly talk about it all. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about a few things and have you discuss the material for people who didn't understand. One of the things is I want to give a big shout out, because I went to Clark University and WPI, and we're here in Worcester, to Robert Goddard. Talk to me about who Robert Goddard was.
Well, he was one of the trio of early rocket pioneers working more or less in isolation and coming to similar conclusions. excuse me. He developed the first first working liquid fuel rocket, and in his early work was widely mocked. There was a notorious New York Times article just decrying how far off Goddard was, and it was so incendiary that in 1969, during the moon landing, the Times published an official retraction because they were so far off when they criticized him.
The important thing about your story is you reported as if you were a classic journalist, in that all sides of the stories. The story is taken, including some stuff that is very, very dark. And I want to talk about Wernher von Braun.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I interviewed Michael Neufeld about his history. And he has a great quote that you quote in the book is, here was a man who had shaken the hands of Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, but also Hitler, Himmler, Goering, and Goebbels.
Yeah.
And he's one of the most problematic people in the history of rocketry.
He sure is. And again, that was one of those I knew vaguely. I had a vague sense about Operation Paperclip, the program to bring Nazi scientists to the U.S. after the war.
Yeah.
But I really didn't know the details. And reading Michael Neufeld's research into von Braun's history was really helpful. He had such a nuanced perspective on the guy. But it's a dark, complicated history. And
I mean, essentially, concentration camp labor helped develop the rocket.
Yeah, and it would have been
many people died. And Wernher von Braun sort of, because of Operation Paperclip, sort of weaseled out. I mean, there's no other way to talk about it. He sort of weaseled out. I mean, he comes to America, and there's a photograph of him posing with Walt Disney.
Yeah, he was the face of rocketry for American kids. He was on Disney. He had a whole show. He converted to Christianity later in life, and he never publicly renounced his past, but there was the sense that maybe he reformed or regretted it. He definitely got away with not having to own up to it.
First of all, there's things that you can regret, and then there's really big things that it's really tough to regret.
Yeah.
Being a Nazi.
Regret's not enough.
Yeah, seriously.
Consequences too.
Well, but the thing that you did really well among many things in this book is the Soviet v. America space race. And, I was alive when Sputnik got launched, and there was a feeling.
Could you hear the beeping?
Yeah. And there was a feeling the United States was going down the tubes.
You know, that that was one of the big revelations for me, that moment, because I grew up hearing stories about that feeling and that sense of Sputnik as this grand shock. But what I didn't realize and what was uncovered to me in the research was just the idea that Eisenhower wasn't particularly shocked by it, that the American government, at least at the higher-ups, sort of knew it was going to happen, and they were relieved it solved a strategic problem, that the Russians went first. It meant the U.S. could launch their spy satellites without getting too much attention.
But none of that was conveyed to the American public at the time. So what you heard on the TV and radio at the time was basically Russia had this mega advanced space program that they were able to do this. And then it was one thing after another that they just kept beating us. Talk about that.
Yeah, it was pretty relentless. And I tried to capture some of that.
You really did.
Just the sense of how every possible milestone that was that the engineers and space planners could conceive of, the Russians already seemed to be on the way to achieving it. And that was one of JFK's big challenges when he came into office and was trying to figure out what to do with space. He polled all of his advisors to try to figure out, well, what's a race that we can actually win? Because we seem to be losing all the other ones. And that was where the idea of going to the moon came out.
I would just want to mention Valentina Tereshkova, who was the first woman in space, who was Soviet, of course. Yuri Gagarin, that name was known to everybody in America. Everybody knew Yuri Gagarin's name.
Yeah.
That was the first person to orbit the Earth, was, again, Russian. When did it finally, when was it finally worked out that we were going to enter the game, put everything in and try to compete?
Well, I think it's 62. 61, 62, Kennedy made the announcement to Congress about the plans, and then in that famous Rice speech to the American public about, channeling American ambition to choose the moon. But the ball started rolling, I'd say, in 1960, behind the scenes with scientific advisors and people close to Kennedy.
And his, what was his, I mean, how did he convince the American public that this was worthwhile?
You know, that's a really good question, because looking back on it, I was struck by how little he says in that public address to the public. You know, it's rhetorically very beautiful, but when he says, why are we going to the moon, the only answer he provides is an anecdote about Sir Edmund Hillary climbing Everest, who said, because it's there. You know, it in hindsight, you wonder, how did he pull this off? I think it was probably less to do with Kennedy and more to do with those around him, Johnson and other Southern senators who managed to rally the cause of all of these NASA research facilities and factories. It was a huge collaboration across the country between industry and academia. And so I don't know if any one person can take credit as the figurehead, but...
Well, there was a whole mythos that if you were alive during those days of the Kennedy, the whole Camelot thing.
Sure.
And I think people just thought, well, that'd be another thing that we should do. Yeah, we'll go to space.
Like, I'm sure if anybody can do it, Kennedy can do it.
Exactly. But he did, you're right. He didn't really talk it up an awful lot. It just sort of made it seem like, of course, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And then we did. And we started out. Now, what's great about your book is the little details. I mean, there's the big stuff, but then there's all the people behind the scenes. And one of my favorites always has been Margaret Hamilton.
Yeah.
Can you talk about her?
Yeah, she was the software designer and engineer on the Apollo guidance computer. And she's got a great story. She was actually the woman who coined the term software engineering, because she was working at a time when there were hardly any women working in that field. And she wanted to do something that could assert her authority over her male coworkers, so she basically adopted the title. But she went from being kind of an afterthought in the program to being the person in charge of figuring out how to program the computer to deal with errors. And it turned out that her work was integral to getting Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin down to the moon, because the computer was overloaded during the descent. And part of the reason why it wasn't a catastrophic failure was safeguards that she programmed in.
There's some amazing photographs, and you reproduce some of them in your book, of just her with stacks.
Yeah, that was the first that was the first picture I saw of her, and obviously that endeared me to figuring out how to include her in the book. You know, she's standing next to the code for the computer, which they'd printed out, and to about like 5 feet worth of paper.
Well, this is what reading your book really brings back to me. In retrospect, now that we're all computer savvy and stuff like that, I can't believe they had the level of computers that they did then and managed to carry this off.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, lots of people like to make the comparison about the computing power that we carry around in our pockets versus what was required to get people to the moon. And, you know, it feels absurd when you look at the statistic or the system requirements on the Apollo computer. But the thing that it's easy to overlook is that the Apollo computer might pale in comparison to our cell phones, but we would never trust our cell phones to keep us alive for 2 weeks at a time without failing.
Oh, like, my God.
When you think about what was at stake, that these computers had to, they had to work flawlessly, otherwise everybody's going to die. That's a totally different order than what we've grown accustomed to.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Jonathan Fetter-Vorm. He is an artist and an author, and he combines his talents in his books. And we've been talking about his latest book, Moonbound, Apollo 11 and the Dream of Spaceflight. I mean, talk about an unforgiving environment. It doesn't get more unforgiving than space. So when crap goes wrong, it really goes wrong badly. Now, there was an accident that happened on January 27th, 1967, and I vividly remember when this happened. That happened on the launch pad.
Yeah, the Apollo 11 fire. It was, I think part of the reason why it was such a tragedy was that nobody really expected anything to happen. You know, it was an afternoon when they were testing the communications equipment, and I think what nobody had planned for was that these astronauts were sitting in the capsule, which was fed with pure oxygen. And nobody had really made the connection that if you fill up a room full of something that's incredibly flammable, and if anything goes wrong, it's a conflagration. And that's exactly what happened.
The three astronauts that died, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. You know, it was a horrific event. But what was amazing is there was a sense of just, okay, we knew this was going to be dangerous. And the astronauts accept that risk, and then they moved on, which is amazing. Today, we'd seem like we would freak out if something like that happened.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And, well, it's important to remember that our astronaut corps has changed, too. These guys were all test pilots. You know, they were part of that first class of astronauts.
Yeah.
That everybody, you know, the right stuff, the Tom Wolfe kind of astronaut, everybody sort of expected that death was part of the job. And I think that was probably important in the beginning of the space program to get, because it was so risky then. But it's, you know, we've moved on to a civilian astronaut corps that's composed of scientists and people with, you know, all sorts of skill sets. So it's no longer that kind of fighter jock mentality. So, but yeah.
What's amazing about your book is it breaks down the whole event of the moon landing into literally everything that happened. And I think that's the first time I've ever read a book that's done that for me, so that I understood it and step-by-step everything that was going on. And there's a lot of little details that I didn't know of. And just one of the ones I want to mention is that when the two astronauts landed in the moon module, the LEM, distances when they're outside were really deceiving.
Oh, yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that I wish I was a better artist so I could represent it. But I learned pretty quickly that drawing the moon is the hardest thing I've ever done. the way that light works, you know, I'm trained to figure out how to represent distance on the page on Earth. By including an atmosphere. You know, we are trained to think that things are farther away when they're hazier, when they're lighter. But the moon doesn't have an atmosphere, so there isn't any of that atmospheric perspective. And it's when you're just drawing that on the page, it then becomes really hard to figure out how to show space when you don't have all your tricks.
It's a strange thing. And plus, the fact it's a smaller body, so there's like a curve
to
the horizon line. So the whole thing,
see the horizon curving.
It's one of those things that I remember seeing the film, but the films were so grainy that they were taking at the time that you never really sort of figured that out. But it didn't look real, which is probably one of the things that started all those hoaxes that this was all just filmed, you know, on a studio stage.
Again,
other little details, like what was left behind after they went back and then returned to Earth. There was a whole bunch of garbage that was left behind.
Oh man, it's amazing. I've actually been spending a lot of time assembling these lists of all the stuff that was left behind. It would not just, you know, once they were done with their mission, they had to get back into space and then go back home. And to do that, they wanted to have as little weight on their craft as possible. So they jettisoned as much as they could. You know, they were taking a bunch of rocks home, so that was the priority. But they got rid of all their gear that wasn't necessary. But then they also left a lot of you know, more curious items. There was an olive branch. There was a piece of the Wright brothers' airplane. There was a commemorative patch for the Apollo 1 fire, as well as for some fallen cosmonauts.
There was a little plaque. There was a little plaque that was left on one of the legs.
Yeah, there's the plaque that was on the, you know, on the ship itself that said, you know, we came in peace for all mankind. But I like how if there ever were future archaeologists from space, we like to think that they would just look at the plaques and the recording that we made of world leaders saying hello. But I think it's important to remember that these alien archaeologists will also have a bunch of garbage bags and, you know, food wrappers to figure out who humans are.
The lunar samples, when they come back, everybody was waiting for some huge thing, and they were just sort of oddly. I remember seeing a moon rock, and it was like, it's a moon rock.
Yeah,
but it's like one of the scientists smelled it and said it smelled like gunpowder.
Yeah, that was one of the technicians who helped, you know, package up the stuff that they'd found. I think that the rocks are a good kind of metaphor for the larger sense of maybe disenchantment that followed our first landing. That we realized that the moon, maybe we were fantasizing about it as a species for millennia, and as this amazing different place, and we come back and realize that it's just a bunch of rock. A very interesting rock, because it tells us a lot of important things that Earth rocks can't. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's...
This brings us to the epilogue of your book, which I thought was really well done. Because it sums up the downfall of the moon program. And let's talk about that, because it became a complicated issue.
Yeah, I wasn't prepared for the... I quote this great kind of New York Times ad hoc poll that a journalist did, where she called up a year after the Apollo 11, she calls up a bunch of people around the country and asking them if they remember, you know, the names of the astronauts that walked on the moon. And she found that most people she talks to couldn't remember their names. And this is in 1971, which just seems crazy that our country would forget so quickly these names that have become, you know, household names.
But it wasn't just neglect. I mean, there was an active backlash.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it was the sense that there were problems in our country, especially when it came to race and poverty and the war in Vietnam, problems that were being completely ignored while we sent, you know, a total 12 men up into space. That the Apollo program was perhaps a huge misdirection of funds that could have done more work if, you know, applied elsewhere.
Well, let me ask you personally, how do you feel about that?
I feel it's hard. Like, the
because you stressing the journalism of this book, you leave all your personal opinion out of this.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if that was a bug or a feature of the book.
No, it's a feature. But, it's a feature.
Okay. Part of it is it's hard to come to terms with this. There's a scene at the Apollo 11 launch. Ralph Abernathy, civil rights leader, leads a poor people's march to protest exactly this, protest the amount of money that NASA and America is spending on the space race and ignoring African Americans and poor people. And Abernathy confronts the NASA administrator about this, and the administrator says, you know, look, we it's easier to solve engineering problems than it is social problems. Like, going to the moon is an easier problem to solve than the problem of racism in America. And I think that there's something to be said for that, even if it seems like it's an egregious amount of money to be spending when we have these social problems. That's part of the reason the money was appropriated and spent, was because it was a problem that could be solved.
How did you feel, do you feel like that also just like to do it for science, you know, and information, is that worth it?
I started this project out thinking that it would be sort of like an extension of my first book, Trinity, about the invention of the atomic bomb, thinking it was going to be a science story. And what I didn't understand is that it was really an engineering story.
That's right.
But the science, I ended up writing about it, you know, Robert Goddard, that he was a rocket scientist, but von Braun was a rocket engineer, was figuring out how to take the things that people like Goddard had learned and apply them. And I think that that difference, that makes all the difference. That talking about engineering, it's a lot more about achieving something than it is about discovering something. And for me, my sympathies were always more towards the scientists, which I guess is probably why I spent a lot of this book writing about the scientists.
It's really interesting that you also talk about, if we ever go to the moon again, it's going to be private billionaires that are going to do it.
It sure seems that way. Although I heard today that my hometown university just got a grant to do the computer on the next lunar lander, which NASA's hoping to send in a year or two. So I think NASA will still have a presence on the moon, but it does look like it's overwhelmingly going to be the result of any one of the billionaire rocket entrepreneurs.
I feel weird about that, having lived through the NASA sort of idealized project. The idea of billionaires doing this just does not sit well, but it may be
it's hard to say. I did point out in my book, though, that it planting an American flag on the moon is its own sort of advertisement.
So that's right.
It's not like we were ever free from that kind of impulse.
We're out of time. This is a beautiful book. Imagine everything that we've been talking about is also fully illustrated in the book by Jonathan. My guest tonight is Jonathan Fettervorm. He's an artist and an author who combines both his talents to create some very interesting history books. And we've been talking about his latest. It's really worth reading. Moonbound, Apollo 11 and the Dream of Spaceflight. Jonathan, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.